And let me start my remarks by acknowledging that as difficult as it has been for those who work at USDA, it has been incredibly difficult for those that we serve at USDA. I understand and appreciate that every farmer, every rancher, every producer in the country has gone through a very, very difficult time with commodity prices being challenging, with COVID, with all of the other issues that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. I realize how difficult it has been. It is a different time. It is a different department, and to a certain extent, I'm a different person coming into this role a second time. So I want to share with you some remarks and some thoughts about the state of agriculture, what we're focusing on at USDA, with the understanding, and I hope it is with understanding, that I've been on the job for about 8 days. So I'm learning and relearning a lot. But I wanted to give you a sense of where our focus will be over the course of the next several months. And let me start by starting at the obvious, which is where we are relative to COVID and COVID relief. I know a lot of questions have been asked about whether or not the department is focused on completing the payments under the CFAP program, under CFAP 2, and under CFAP AA. And I wanted to give you an update on that. When I came into office, it was pretty clear that there were a significant number of folks who had been impacted negatively by COVID along the entire supply chain of our food and agriculture industry. An industry, by the way, that is incredibly important to the country from an economic standpoint, and we learned this during the COVID. The reality is that this is an industry that employs nearly more than 20% of the entire American workforce, and it's an industry that impacts and affects nearly a quarter of our entire economy. So when COVID hit, obviously there were a substantial number of folks in the industry, in the food and ag industry, that have been negatively impacted. With previous COVID packages, some, but not all, of those in that supply chain have been helped and assisted to get through this crisis. So first and foremost, we wanted to do an evaluation at USDA to determine precisely what the need is out there, how many folks and how many groups and how many organizations and entities within the supply chain need help and assistance, who has received assistance, who has received some assistance but not enough, and who hasn't received any assistance at all. We're in the process of sort of completing that analysis here, and I expect and anticipate within the next several weeks, we're going to be in a position to let folks know, at least preliminarily, what our thoughts are as we go forward with these COVID relief packages. While we're considering this, we're also watching with some anticipation the passage of the American Rescue Plan, which is currently being debated in the Senate. That's going to provide additional resources, and so we wanted to make sure that we understood and appreciated the full range of need and the full range of resources that might potentially be available before we made decisions about how best to allocate those resources. But we know that it's important, and we know that people are waiting, and we're going to try to get some answers to folks as quickly as we can. I want to share a statistic with you that I got as I was preparing for my Senate confirmation hearing. I was taking a look at ERS information about the state of agriculture and the state of farming and the state of income in agriculture, and I saw this chart that essentially talked about where money for farmers and ranchers and producers, where they get their money, how they make their living. And this chart basically showed that 89.6% of American farm families currently do not make the majority of the money that they do earn from their farming operation. Saying this another way, nearly 90% of American farmers require off-farm income by themselves, a job, a spouse's job, maybe even the kids are working as well off the farm, in order to maintain and keep the farm. That is a very difficult statistic for a Secretary of Agriculture to repeat to a group of producers here today, because it suggests that we need to do a lot better job, and we need to do a lot more work to create a situation in an industry where more people can make the majority of what they make from what they want to do and what they love to do. So the focus for us over the course of the next several months and for the next 4 years is going to be on markets, more markets, better markets, newer markets, and fairer markets. And let me briefly touch on all four of those areas. In the area of more markets, I begin with trade, because 20 to 30% of what is grown and raised in this country ultimately is exported outside of the country. And I learned a lot of lessons in the last 4 years working for the dairy industry at the Export Council, that we need to continue to focus on providing greater presence for U.S. Products in markets. Presence means more people on the ground in those markets, more partnerships with institutions and universities to have a better understanding of what each market requires, and more promotions to make sure that the U.S. brand is well-known and well-accepted and well-received in markets. So we're going to focus our attention and resources at USDA on providing assistance to allow for greater presence in key markets, and we know what those markets are. More markets involves as well in the enforcement of trade agreements that have already been entered into and enforced in the way in which those trade agreements were negotiated. I'm speaking specifically of the USMCA. I just recently had an opportunity to have conversations with the Minister of Agriculture in Canada, and I brought up issues relative to wheat and the need for Canada to be or open to the various varieties of wheat that is grown in the United States, and also talked to her as well on dairy issues. Then I had an opportunity to visit with the Secretary of Agriculture from Mexico, and I expressed a concern that many of us share about Mexican attitude about genetically engineered crops and the need and importance of having those crops being able to get into their market without barriers or interference, and received assurances from a feed perspective that it will be the case, that in fact there will be continued access to that incredible market and the opportunity potentially to grow that market. More markets also means looking at ways in which we potentially could have new trade agreements. And I'm pleased with the fact that we've taken a step in the Biden-Harris administration to send a signal to the UK and to the EU of a potential opportunity for us to negotiate with the relaxation of the various tariffs that have currently been in place because of the Airbus and Boeing dispute. Maybe that gives us an opportunity to have a conversation about trade agreements in both the UK and the EU. Maybe it gives us an opportunity to open the door with the understanding that any trade agreement must include open access to our agricultural products in order for it to be successful. And of course, you can't have a conversation of trade without talking about China in phase one. Certainly, it is important and necessary for us to continue to see that relationship provide the purchases that we've recently seen. I was asked earlier today by a member of the media whether I could, whether I was confident about China's continued purchases. And my answer was that I'm confident as long as the relationship is focused on trade, because China needs what the U.S. can provide, and China needs a lot of what we can provide. And we've seen recent purchases from China reflect their need and our ability to meet the need. But the reality is our China relationship is complex, and it's not simply based on trade, but it has multiple layers. And some of those layers in which we compete with China on the world scene. In some of those layers, we are cooperating with China on some major issues like climate change and cyber terrorism. So it's a complicated relationship. And on any given day, because of a complexity in some other aspect of the relationship, it may have a negative impact on our trade relationship. So it's important for the Department of Agriculture, for the Secretary of Agriculture, to be engaged in conversations within the national security discussions to make sure that decisions that are being made that could have an implication and impact on agriculture are well understood before decisions are made. And I've continued to make the case that agriculture needs to be more engaged and more involved and more connected, if you will, to those conversations. So that's more markets focused on trade. What do I mean by better markets? Well, by better markets, I mean open and transparent markets. I think it's fair to say that there is a lot of concern about consolidation in agriculture in a variety of areas. And we're going to do what we can at USDA to make sure that we have adequate price discovery, that we strengthen rules for a more competitive environment to make sure that farmers are treated fairly in the market. And to the extent that there are issues relative to unfair activities, that we're going to be a department that supports farmers and works for farmers and enforces fair trade and fair trade opportunities and open markets and fairer markets. We're going to highlight where competitive markets are working well within the U.S. and make sure that people understand what a competitive market looks like. We're going to invest as well, I hope, in more processing facilities. We learned during the course of COVID that our supply chain was easily disrupted, that the transition from food going into food service to food being needed in food assistance was somewhat dependent on our ability to continue to process. And when COVID struck meatpacking facilities in my home state of Iowa, we saw a disruption in markets. We need to make sure that our markets are far more resilient. And so investing in additional processing opportunities and additional processing facilities will allow us to have more competitive markets. What do I mean by new markets? Well, I mean a focus on climate and the ability to create new opportunities for farmers to profit by sequestering carbon. Farmers profit by embracing practices that we know are climate smart, that we know produce regenerative results, that we know will improve the soil health. We're losing about 4.5 tons of topsoil per acre per year in the United States. We're only naturally replacing about 0.5 ton an acre of topsoil. So this is an issue that is, I think, incredibly important to the future of agriculture and the ability for us to maintain and continue productivity. So we need to be investing in and supporting and providing incentives and encouragement for farmers to continue to embrace practices that they're already embracing, from cover crops to crop diversity to rotational grazing and other practices that we know will have a positive impact on soil health and water quality. By investing in those practices, we're also going to do right by the environment. And we're also going to do right by climate. And by creating opportunities, perhaps through a carbon bank of sorts that would be focused and designed specifically to benefit farmers. Today in America, we have about 135, 138 million carbon credits that are currently outstanding in various markets. But the reality is only about 2.5 million of those credits are focused on agriculture. And it's because they aren't necessarily designed. Those systems are not designed to benefit farmers. If we're going to get into this business of incenting and providing new revenue streams for carbon sequestration, we have to create and design and implement programs in a way that benefits farmers, not necessarily in the investor class, but farmers. Because it's the farmers who are going to be sequestering the carbon. It's the farmers who are going to provide some of the early wins, if you will, in an effort on climate. And so we're going to be focused at USDA on trying to figure out how best to structure a program that creates that new revenue stream that supports the conservation programs that already exist to create new opportunities for farmers. We're also going to look for ways in which agricultural waste produced on the farm can be converted into a variety of new products. We have history with this in terms of the renewable fuel industry, but I think we can expand significantly beyond that. I know that there are ways in which manure, for example, from dairy operations can be converted into a number of different products that can create new revenue streams for farmers and basically reduce the carbon footprint and emission footprint of a dairy operation. We can reach the president's goal of a zero emission agriculture by 2050 by embracing new opportunities to convert agricultural waste. This creates new revenue opportunities for farmers. It also will create more manufacturing jobs and processing jobs in rural towns across America. The Department of Agriculture needs to be engaged in making sure that's part of our future. I spoke briefly about the Renewable Fuel Standard, and I'm certainly pleased to see the Environmental Protection Agency recently indicating that their approach to waivers on the RFS will be significantly different than under the previous administration, and I think that's the right decision. The waiver program, which was designed to provide assistance and help for small refineries that were struggling to meet the renewable fuel standard requirements, made sense. But what didn't make sense necessarily was providing those waivers to large-scale refineries that were owned by large-scale oil and oil companies. A return to a day when waivers were very, very sparsely granted will provide greater flexibility, greater predictability for the renewable fuel industry, which in turn should help to support that industry. So I'm pleased with that. I've had the opportunity to have conversations with Michael Regan, who is designated as the EPA administrator, not yet confirmed, but I believe he will be confirmed. And when he is, I think we will have a good, positive relationship. He understands and appreciates that what happens at EPA has an impact and effect on what happens at USDA and the people that we care about. He understands it's important to be consistent in decision-making. He understands it's important to be transparent in decision-making, and he understands that it's important to have a line of communication between our two departments and agency so that we know when and if there are issues being discussed that impact and affect agriculture, that we have the opportunity to make sure that they fully understand and appreciate what that decision will mean for you on the ground. So I'm excited about that relationship and looking forward to working with Michael and the team at APA. When I talk about fair markets, I'm really talking about addressing the equity issues that have plagued the Department of Agriculture for quite some time. We have dealt with individual acts of discrimination at the department from time to time. We've compensated people for those individual acts. But what hasn't happened is we've not been able to address the cumulative effect of discrimination over many, many decades, and the fact that it has put some farmers significantly behind their counterparts. And so we will be spending some time at USDA trying to figure out creative ways to essentially create greater equity in what we do at USDA and providing better opportunities as well for socially disadvantaged farmers who have struggled. This is going to take an opportunity for us to really review deeply and comprehensively the various programs at USDA in a way that will allow us to identify any barriers that has systemic racism or systemic barriers that have prevented full participation in our programs. We're committed to this. We think it's the right thing to do. The president has been very clear and the vice president's been very clear about the importance of doing this. And it will potentially provide an opportunity for us to also expand the number of farmers in this country. We obviously are deeply concerned about making sure that we keep people on the land and keep people on the farm. And one additional way besides more markets and better markets and newer markets is to make sure that we also have a fair system. And last but certainly not least, part of my job that I've learned coming back into the department is rebuilding the workforce at USDA. I recently received a report on the number of vacancies that exist throughout the department. And I know that there are vacancies in some key areas that impact and affect the people watching this program today. Whether it's at FSA offices or whether it's NRCS, the vacancy rates are pretty high. And we're going to do what we can to address that within the budget resources that we have to make sure that we have people on the ground being able to do the work that's so important to all of you. We have a dedicated workforce. They are anxious to get back to work and get back in the office. We're obviously not going to do that until we can safely do it. We're going to make sure that our workers are protected. We're going to make sure that our essential workers are protected so that we don't have any further disruption in terms of processing along the supply chain. We're going to make sure that we advocate for agricultural workers, for those who are working in processing facilities, to be vaccinated as per the CDC guidelines, because they are now a priority group. And we're going to do everything we possibly can to make sure that we have a safe workforce and a safe workplace. And I think if we focus our attention on these strategies of more markets and better markets and newer markets and fairer markets, what we will see, I think, over time is a better economic opportunity for more farm families in this country. As you know, I know how important you all are. I know the value system that you represent. I know the important work that you do in your communities. I know how deeply you care about your land and the ability and the opportunity to transfer that opportunity to the next generation. And I commit to you that I'll do everything I possibly can with all the energy I have to be a Secretary of Agriculture that helps to create more opportunities. So with that, Gail, let me turn it back to you. I know there's some questions, which hopefully I can answer. In the remaining time that we have. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be with everybody today.
Thank you, Tom. Applause is being heard in the background right now, even though it's virtual. Thank you, Tom, for those comments. We appreciate it. Tom, during your confirmation hearings, we heard you in support of a lot of the biofuels, including your support for the higher blend biofuels and higher efficient engines. And even in some states, we're actually seeing, or at least pushing, for electric vehicles within the next 15 years. How does that going to affect the ethanol industry? And what will you and the new USDA do to support the renewable fuel standard?
Gail, there are roughly 232 million cars and vehicles in the American vehicle fleet today. And when I was testifying, I indicated that I was the owner and operator of a 2007 automobile. Since that time, I've donated that automobile to a family, an immigrant family that is trying to make a living and needed a car. And so they now have the benefit of that vehicle, but there were only 75,000 miles on that vehicle. And that's the reason I kept it for 13 years. I mean, the reality is that a lot of us keep our cars for a long period of time. And this is a way of saying that it is unlikely that we're going to see a significant number of electric vehicles, and where it's unlikely that we're going to see in 15 years an elimination of combustion engine vehicles. We're going to continue to still have those vehicles. And I think that the renewable fuel industry and the renewable fuels are part of the strategy to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels that are harming the environment. I mean, the recent studies of the efficiency and effectiveness of renewable fuel, of its impact on the environment, and the fact that there are fewer emissions connected to renewable fuel than to regular fuel, makes it essential that we continue to look for ways to continue to use renewable fuel as part of our fuel mix. And I think the reality is that we'll be around, I don't know if I'll be around, but most of you will be around 20 years or 30 years from now. And I think you're still going to have a need for and a demand for and a higher demand for renewable fuels. Secondly, I think there are other opportunities as well to expand this industry. You mentioned, higher performing cars. Well, if we're truly interested in stretching the miles that we get out of our cars and out of a gallon of gas, it's going to be necessary for us to focus on octane. And there's only one way to get to high enough octane to get you to a higher mileage standards, and that's through renewable fuel. So I think there's a second compelling reason for doing this and for continuing to have this industry. And then there are, of course, jobs connected to it, better for the environment from an air quality perspective. So there are multiple reasons why this industry is important. And I think the reality is it's going to be around for quite some time. I think there are also ways in which the renewable fuels can be extended into other transportation forms. I understand an electric car, I understand the battery issue. But what I do know about that is that if the battery wears out or for some reason you don't have any electricity anymore and you need to fill it up a little bit, well, the only thing that's going to happen to you is you're going to pull the car on the side of the road and you're going to stop and you're going to make a phone call and you're going to get help. But I don't know about a battery-powered airplane, or for that matter, a battery-powered boat or ship. I think there are aviation and marine opportunities that could potentially also create new portions of this industry that we will have to continue to meet with renewable energy and renewable fuel. So I think we're going to continue to have the industry. I think we have opportunities for growth. And I think in terms of supporting it, it's several things. One, it's making sure that we have that relationship with the EPA and making sure that they do, in fact, very sparsely use the waiver requirements and waiver opportunities, and also making sure that we look for opportunities to have consistency. And when the renewable fuel standard is up for renewal, that we work with our friends in Congress to make sure that it continues, because this is an important part of our fuel mix, important part of our transportation strategy. And it's also using our procurement dollars and the federal government to support the industry as well. And one of the things we will do at USDA is to make sure that as we're buying new vehicles, that yes, we may buy electric vehicles, but we're also going to buy vehicles that use biofuel.
Mr. Secretary, Susan Littlefield out of the Rural Radio Network said that recently that the Nebraska Congressman Don Bacon said that work is already starting on the next farm bill. And Mr. Secretary, considering the world that we're in right now, what type of changes do you see or would you like to see in crafting the next farm bill?
Well, I tell you, Gail, before we craft the next farm bill, I think we have to work between now and, say, the next year or two to take a look at what we need to do to create more, better, and newer markets and fairer markets. And that is going to help to inform, in part, what a farm bill ought to include. So, for example, if we are able to establish some kind of carbon bank that's designed for and implemented for farmers and benefiting farmers, We do this, I suspect, in a way that we begin that process. We provide sufficient resources to get it started, but also to learn from the early experiences of that, what works and what doesn't work. If we basically refocus our conservation programs on climate smart agriculture, on regenerative practices, on soil health initiatives, on cleaner water, what will we learn as we do that in terms of how well we can refocus those programs? What do we need to do in terms of beefing up or increasing the commitment to those programs or figuring out additional ways to incent those activities? How does that factor into a farm bill? So I think part of what we want to do is use the next year to 2 years of basically, test marketing a lot of these concepts, learning from that experience, and then using that experience to better inform the development and creation of a farm bill and working with Congress. Obviously, Congress is the one that crafts this, but providing the information where they are confident that they're doing the right thing. Again, not to belabor the point, but we can't say to ourselves, when nearly 90% of our producers are not making a majority of the money from what they do and what they love to do, that we've got the system, we've got it figured out. There's more that we need to do. And I think that obviously has to impact and affect what we do in terms of farm bill. So I think you're going to see a lot of work now that will help inform and create a better farm bill in the future.
Mr. Secretary, our international policy, our trade policy has been really on a wild roller coaster event for the past several years. And we survived the trade war as producers. We've endured the peaks and the valleys. And actually, we've gotten to see the upside of it thus far and the peak side recently. And at least would think that it's a credible argument that some of the tactics by the previous administration did bear some fruit. You were on the front lines of a lot of that volatility with the Dairy Export Federation. What do you see as some of the good things from the past 4 years that could be built upon for the next four?
Well, Gail, I'm not sure that we can say with confidence that we survived the trade war. I think unfortunately, tragically, there were a lot of farmers that did not survive the trade war that ended up having to leave the farm. And that's always an incredibly sad circumstance. I think we have to acknowledge that. I think we also have to acknowledge that where we are relative to trade, especially with China, is pretty much where we were in 2017. It's not as if they're buying more than they were buying before. In fact, our market share in China was in 2017 roughly 25% of their agricultural purchases were from the U.S. Today, it's 15%. So I think we have to put this in perspective. I think the benefit of that did accrue is that China did make a number of commitments in the sanitary and phytosanitary area, which had been negotiated and which had been discussed for an extended period of time, which China is now doing. They opened up access to their beef market, for example. But they haven't fully engaged with a regulatory system that allows for more rapid adoption of some of the genetically engineered technologies that are important. And so I think there's still work to be done, but certainly the benefit of opening up markets, of reducing barriers, of making it a little bit easier to get into that market was certainly beneficial. But I think we still, the jury's still out, if you will, on precisely the impact of this. And certainly if, for whatever reason, China fails to meet its phase one requirements in year two, then I think we have to maybe begin the process of asking China what more can be done in order for you to meet those requirements, because they're about 80% of what they promised they would buy, certainly better than it was, and certainly helpful to the market, no question, and a good thing. But they're not where they need to be. And they're not where we want them to be. And I think the other thing that I take from this is that as important as that market is, we have got to make sure that we are diversifying our market opportunities so that we're not overly dependent on a single market, because we saw the consequences of that when we did have a disruption in the relationship with China. And on any given day, something may happen in the South China Sea or in Taiwan or in Hong Kong or someplace else that creates a friction between our two countries that may impact and affect that trade agreement. So it's important for us, I think, to look at other areas of the world. Now, that means being aggressive on trying to open up new market opportunities in places like the UK, and maybe over time in places like India, where we have a potential opportunity. It means focusing on Southeast Asia, which is a growing economy with middle classes that are consuming more and will need more protein. And what can we do to address that opportunity? It means also, as I said earlier, the implementation of the USMCA and making sure it's implemented in the way in which it was intended and written. And it means, frankly, having a longer view as well on trade, making sure that as Africa continues to grow and populations continue to increase, that in countries in Africa that we are learning the rules of the road, learning how to play the game in that continent, and in countries in that continent, so that we don't cede opportunity solely and completely to our competitors in a place where one half of the world's increased population is going to come from in the next 10 to 15 years. So I think there's a lot of work on the trade agenda that needs to be focused on. And I'm confident the new U.S. Trade Representative, who I've had an opportunity to visit with briefly, is up to the task.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The last 7 years or so, we've seen low commodity prices, and it's basically showed us a number of things. And perhaps the most importantly, that they've illustrated the importance of helping farmers escape that perhaps more the price taking of both inputs as well as production. However, to properly put farmers out of this vicious circle, we need a competitive footing in the marketplace. The infrastructure is going to be necessary. There has been some discussion of an infrastructure initiative spearheaded by President Biden's administration. What would such an initiative look like, do you think, Mr. Secretary? And how would projects beyond the Mississippi River improvements be prioritized?
Well, you know, I think there's no question. If you talk to any engineer about the state of the gray infrastructure in this country, the transportation infrastructure, the utility infrastructure, the waterways, inland waterway infrastructure, that there is a significant need for modernization, a significant need for investing incredibly large sums of money to rebuild and to improve our transportation systems. Our utility systems, our inland waterway systems, and also a tremendous responsibility to expand, ultimately, access to broadband in every area, every corner, every niche, of America. If we're going to be serious about precision agriculture, if we're going to try to collect data and make more informed decisions about how we use our land, you're going to have broadband. If you're going to create more and you're going to have more markets, you're going to have to make sure that you can get that product to market most efficiently, which means your transportation systems need to be improved. Your lock and dam systems need to be improved, but your ports need to be improved. Your rail systems need to be improved. It's about jobs. It's about growing the economy. It's about preparing us for a very significant competition with a number of other countries, not the least of which would be China, as we discussed earlier. So I think that's part of what it looks like. And I think there's also green infrastructure, and it gets back to this whole issue of climate and the ability to invest and make sure that we are recognizing the opportunities to capture methane, for example, and converting it into fuel and energy. That will take infrastructure, that will take a significant amount of infrastructure that needs to be invested. If we're really serious about sequestering carbon, how are we going to store it? Where are we going to store it? What do we do with CO2? What do we do with how can we use it? How can we redirect it? How can we avoid that waste product? What can we do with it? Can we convert it into something more significant? Can we store it? Where can we store it? What infrastructure do we need to store it? So I think there are a lot of opportunities here, but it's going to require the political will to be able to do it and to understand that we've learned a few lessons about COVID from COVID. We're digging ourselves out of the economic hole and the healthcare hole. And frankly, we will be able to accelerate that process if more of us get vaccinated. That's why there's an emphasis on vaccinations. That's why the USDA is actually utilizing some of its staff to help with vaccinations, creating new opportunities to accelerate that so we get on the other side of COVID more quickly, so we can restore and resume a regular economy. And so we can then begin to shift our focus instead of COVID relief and emergency relief and disaster assistance, that we can really focus on investing in the future, and that's infrastructure.
Follow-up for that, Mr. Secretary, is the USDA going to follow the congressional dictates from their relief package that was passed back in December to provide assistance to cattle producers who did not receive the CFAP money last spring for those cattle that were sold between April 15th and May the 15th? Will there be fresh payment initiatives associated with that?
Yeah, that's part of the evaluation that's taking place right now, is trying to figure out precisely what the demand and need is. Who has not been helped? Who has been helped but inadequately helped across the entire supply chain? And then matching that up and marrying it with the resources that have been provided to determine how best to meet all of those needs in the most appropriate way. That's what we're grappling with right now. And we want, at the end of all of this, when all is said and done, when the history is written about COVID relief, we want to make sure that the history basically says that the people that needed the help got the help, and that no one was essentially left out or forgotten about, because everybody in the supply chain is important. I mean, there are demands, significant demands. You've mentioned one of them. The biofuel industry was an entity that didn't receive a great deal of help during this COVID situation. That's another. There are a variety of specialty crop producers that were not helped and assisted, even though they were significantly impacted. There were folks in the supply chain that expended enormous sums of money to make sure that they could protect their workers. Are they entitled to reimbursement, if you will? So I think there are a lot of very important questions that I would hope everybody would expect us to ask. And the fact that Congress has designated a number of entities that, in their view, did not receive support or adequate help and assistance is an indication of the need for us to really be thoughtful about this. That's why we continued the sign-up for the CFAP program. That's why we will continue the sign-up once we sort of lay out the plan, and I expect that to happen hopefully in the near term. As we lay out that plan, we'll give people additional opportunities, an additional 30 days to sign up. There may be someone who doesn't think they qualify for help, that now they find out that they do. We don't want a situation that when they find out, they don't have time to apply for the help. So we want to set this up in a thoughtful way, in a comprehensive way, and to give people some sense of direction about what's next. I suspect we're going to find that the amount of money that we have, it will be difficult to meet all of the needs that have already been articulated and those that are still coming in. But we're going to try to be creative. There may be circumstances where monies within regular programs have not yet been expended that could be of help as well, that could complement and supplement what we can with the COVID packages. And so we're looking at this thing very comprehensively and very thoughtfully.
Mr. Secretary, all of us producers from corn and soybean, wheat and sorghum have some serious concerns about, from the agricultural standpoint, the re-registration of some of the crop protection tools tied to the Endangered Species Act. With precision ag, and we're getting a lot better and better at gathering ag data, yet other agencies continue to use more conservative, less precise models in their evaluations. How can you and the USDA help us with that challenge?
Well, I think I alluded to the fact that we need to create a line of communication that's consistent, constant, and comprehensive with our friends at EPA, and making sure that as they are contemplating decisions relative to their job, that they're congressionally mandated or by a court decision directed to do, that they are cognizant and conscious of the potential impact it can have on agriculture, and that they reach out to us and ask for advice, counsel, guidance about the impact, and in turn, that we keep an eye as well at USDA on the activities at EPA to make sure that that if something is being considered, that we are able to provide our viewpoint, our perspective on it, and then have a conversation with our friends at EPA to fully understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. And they fully understand its impact on agriculture. And if there is a circumstance and situation where something that they are considering that they're required to do by court order or required to do by Congress, they do, that may have an impact on agriculture, then it's up to us at USDA to ask ourselves, are there ways in which we can assist in farmers meeting the responsibilities and requirements of whatever EPA may decide to do? We don't have we don't have veto power over what EPA does. They're a separate entity, separate organization. They have separate congressional directives and courts that are overseeing their activities. We have to respect that. But we can have a relationship of information sharing and communication, and we can try to analyze the impact and effect things can have on farmers and try to mitigate, to the extent there's a negative impact, we can try to mitigate the impact of that.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. You served some time in between your two stints of Secretary of Agriculture in the private sector, more specifically with the dairy. And do you feel like that you're bringing any new skills and thoughts and ideas to the Secretary's desk now, bringing back to the department from your experiences that you've had in the private sector?
Well, I don't know about skills, but I do know that I have a deeper understanding of trade and the important work that's being done and needs to be done by commodities in these markets. As part of our dairy effort was to increase our presence, and we convinced dairy farmers to provide more resources to the department, to the United States Dairy Export Council, to create more people on the ground so that we'd have more folks getting insights as to what the market wants and needs. We created a series of partnerships with universities and other entities to look at potential innovations and new products that could be created that would utilize U.S. dairy products, for example. Those relationships also helped us in part by having closer relationships with government officials who in turn were connected to those universities. And that resulted in part in work done, real sort of blocking and tackling work that was done in by our trade policy folks to help reduce a tariff here or there or to reduce a barrier. So I think I have a better understanding of what it takes to deepen the presence, to have greater success. We had we set an export record last year for dairy exports. We set in 2018, we also set a record for dairy exports. So I'm confident that a deeper presence, more promotions, more partnerships, more activities that are focused on understanding the market and speaking to the market can result in increased sales. Obviously, more trade agreements helps. Enforcing trade agreements appropriately helps as well. I'm confident that, knock on wood, if things continue on as we expect and as we forecast, we may look at a record year for exports across U.S. agriculture generally in 2021, which would certainly be helpful. And if that actually happens, it will certainly continue to support some of the stronger commodity prices we've recently seen.
Well, the FSA has become so very important, Tom, and Mr. Secretary, Could you kind of fill us in as our last question of this session, filling some of those key USDA roles, what the timeline might very well be from some of your valuable undersecretary positions to even the state FSA directors? Can you give us some idea of your timeline on that?
Well, that is there are two aspects of the Armed Service Agency in your question. One is on the ground, the offices that are currently in many parts of the country not open because they can't be safely opened, and where there are vacancies in those offices that makes it harder, even when they are open, to meet all the needs and demands of farmers. And we're trying to address that vacancy rate as quickly as we possibly can. It's not something that can be done overnight because we didn't get into this situation overnight. We've seen a reduction effort over the last several years. So we need to take a look at where we need more personnel to be able to get the job done. On the state committee side of it, and on FSA to state directors, it's not solely up to the Department of Agriculture and the Secretary of Agriculture to determine who, when, and where, and how. It's really a cooperative effort between the Secretary's office and the USDA, Presidential Personnel Office, PPO, at the White House, and Congress. Senior members of Congress weighing in with suggestions about who might be best to serve in that capacity, because the reality is I may know Iowa, but I don't necessarily know Illinois and the personnel in Illinois. But I suspect that Senator Durbin, for example, in Illinois, would have a pretty good idea of who might be a good person or persons for those jobs. So it's a process of reaching out, getting names, running those names through the personnel office, making sure that they vet properly and all of that, and making sure that they fit the profile, that we continue to have diversity and inclusion as part of that selection process, so that we have an FSA and a USDA that looks like the America we serve, and then making the decision. So it's going to take a little time, but hopefully not too much time, because I understand how important those positions are.
Mr. Secretary, we really appreciate your time. And from all of us as producers, thank you for giving us so much time during this this special edition of Commodity Classic. I'm going to give you a final chance to maybe closing comments, a couple of minutes. If you have some closing comments, Mr. Secretary, for producers across this land.
Well, just an expression of appreciation for the work that they do every single day. I want them to know that we're dedicated at USDA to trying to figure out how we can create better opportunities, more markets, better markets, newer markets, fairer markets, all of which I think will benefit producers across the board. And so I look forward to continuing working with all of you. And I will say, Gail, I'm back in this job, but some things don't change. And you mentioned Orrin Samuelson. It's amazing to me that the voice of American agriculture continues. And I suspect that means that around November, December, he'll be at the USDA office interviewing me for his annual Secretary Says session. So I look forward to that, and I express my regards to him as well.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We do appreciate you and what you have in store for your next, not very many of us come out of the fire and then jump right back into it. So we value your opinion, your background, and also your appreciation for ag, the ag economy, and more importantly, the farm families and operations out here that you will be so important of serving our role in feeding not only the nation, but also the world. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all. Everyone stay safe and be well.